Now, I'm told that I'm not standing between you and dinner, so don't hate me here if I go a little bit long.
We have wine, so we're good.
Oh, you're good. Well, and some have beer as well. I think that's why they're so happy looking out there. Before I get started, I would like to say that I am impressed with Novus, and particularly it appears that the administration gets it. It's not often that you find a firm that when they hear of an outside force, such as the word sustainability and not knowing what it means and how many threats it may offer to a firm, that they hide from it. And I don't see that. I see you guys taking it head on. And so I like to commend you on that, because we don't run into that very often. So I feel like I'm preaching to the choir here. You'll see my first statement here. The future of sustainability and food supply chain depends on prices of sustainable consumer goods, which is determined by a whole bunch of things. Before I go into that, let me ask you, how many of you believe that over the next 10 years, food is going to increase in price? Okay, a few of you not. How about energy prices, petrol prices in particular? Are they going to increase or decrease? Increase. How many for increase? Okay, all right. So these outside drivers are some of the things I'm going to talk about. First, I'm going to look at the demand side, then the supply side, some of the global trade policies, and then some of the sustainable push-pull factors and how they influence the firm or our markets. And what can an industry, how can an industry look at this and get control over some of these issues? If you look at the outlook that FAO and OECD put together, and I'm sorry, this is kind of small, but in general, you see that they projected a huge increase, and then kind of what we're experiencing now, a deflation, right? And then an overall leveling out, but at much higher than what we were prior to this shock of the gasoline shock, okay? So what do they project over the next 10 years? So from the previous decade to the next decade, what do you expect? We expect to see 40-60% higher for wheat and maize, 80% higher for vegetable oils, 30% for raw sugar. On the animal side, we expect 20% higher for beef and pork, some of the animal byproducts you'll see also are expected to be higher. Now, why is this important before I get into the demand factors? It's important because last year, what happened? You had 30 countries that had food riots. And they had food riots because food was too expensive for them. Okay? There was a protest. One or two governments were toppled. All right. But what does this translate into? If you look at the expenditure share of food, so my first set of countries show how much people spend out of their budget on food. 29.6 in Peru, all the way up to 64.5 in Bangladesh. Okay? And then you have more of the industrialized countries. You'll see that, you know, the U.S. is always around 10, 11, and so on. These numbers are fairly small, with the exception of Poland. When you had this increase last year, this is 2007, 2008, when you had this increase last year, here's the total increase in overall prices and what percent food contributed to it. Okay? And what you'll see is that some of these countries responded quite a bit to this change, like 12.4% increase in food prices. That is a concern, because we have to think about sustainability in a global picture, which we heard about all today. So I'm going to go through the factors on the demand side that influence higher prices over the next decade, and then the supply side, and then we'll get into some other external things. First reason why we think prices are going to be higher: reserves. You'll see that we're at some of the lowest reserve levels we've ever had for maize and for wheat. Low reserves always equal higher prices. Okay? Point number one. And please feel free to stop me at any time and ask me questions. Second, and I heard, I believe you talked about this today. Look at how fast we have started doubling our population. We're to the point now of adding 800 million people per year. How do you feed these people? Where do they live? What are the demands that they have on our food supply chain? What does this mean for sustainability? You will get a copy of these slides as well, so I'm going to motor through. We know that the fastest growing cities are not in the U.S. and they're not in Europe. The fastest growing cities, top 100, Asia, Africa, Latin America, and you only have four there in North America, and zero in Europe. What does this mean for our food distribution systems and logistics? And I think I heard Nova speaking about today how they're producing in other locations. Well, when you think about sustainability, transportation and logistics is a major issue. So when you have increase in urbanization, it also causes some other factors to come about. So if we look at the income growth over time, and this line represents the industrialized countries called developed economies, the yellow line, and so this is the share of the global GDP percent versus those of emerging nations. And you'll see that the emerging nations are growing, and we've peaked. Second point, if you look at increase percent increase from the year earlier, okay, each one of those is based on the year earlier, the divergence, so once again, just showing that the emerging economies are growing faster than the industrialized economies. What else do we know about emerging countries and the food demand? 2000, emerging countries were home to 56% of the middle class, projected to be 93% by 2030. 93% of your middle class and the diets that go along with that by 2030. Of course, we expect China and India to make up a lot of that, right? And you see that two-thirds of this expansion, China's 52% and India 12%, and that increase. This is an interesting side note, and I think this is important to this crowd in particular. China and India have a grain area of between 0.15 and 0.16 acres per person, which is the size that required Japan and Taiwan to aggressively import food. I have a following slide that will drill that home. All right, so I showed you that population is growing. I showed you that population growth is not in our industrialized countries. And I showed you that it's urban growth. Well, that brings on, once again, a lot of new issues for our food supply chain. Higher demand for meats, fruits, and vegetables is what's expected. More grain demanded as it takes 3 pounds to produce 1 pound of beef. All this creates greater demand for our water resources and other resources. We expect less people to understand agriculture as well, and that will change our trading rules. It will impact how we do production systems, and I will talk about that more in the sustainability part. So we increase in demand. We expect an increase in demand in animal and worker welfare. Concerns for environmental impact and more regulation are the other things that we expect. Okay. So, yes.
Go back on that last part. Increasing demand for animal worker welfare. I mean, if that gets us into a situation where we have to make a choice between enhancing animal welfare versus feeding or sustaining or utilizing our resources, I think we'll get to the point of having to choose between one and the other.
Yeah. In some markets, I think yes. I think California is approaching that market, and I know that the same people that I'm talking about, Proposition 2 in California with the caging of animals. I think yes, for some markets, those same people are moving to other states. They're in Michigan now, and you know we would expect to see those same type of things on the ballot. In parts of Europe, I expect that. But then you go to the rest of the world, you know, China, India, where grades in Africa, Latin America, where the majority of people are, and grades and standards are not at the same level. So I wouldn't expect the concern to be in the next 10 years, I wouldn't expect this to happen. Okay? Now, how it could happen, though, is it depends on if they are exporting. If you want the export market, then you will be adopting some of these. And what we've seen, like in Kenya, when you increase the grades and standards for export, everyone has number two quality. That stays in the country, and that population starts to become more acclimated to higher quality goods. Okay? Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Another driver on the demand side, biofuels production, and here your largest producers, you know, Argentina, Ukraine, Brazil, China, Canada, EU, USA. Over here you have ethanol, these are in millions of gallons, and biodiesel. Okay? And you'll see that this industry is, you know, just starting to grow. This is a major concern for a lot of countries. I just sent my student to South Africa today to go collect data on food versus fuel trade-offs, because South Africa is a first and third world country. In some countries, this is a major issue. However, there's a lot of countries investing in land and this type of production. So I think like 3.5 million hectares are being invested in just Mozambique alone. Okay, so when you siphon off food products, what does that mean to prices? And remember, my whole thesis is that sustainability depends on prices, right? As you take $1 bushel increase of corn, what does it result in the overall price index for food? And you see for beef, it's like 3.7. These are U.S. numbers, by the way. Pork, 3.2, and poultry, 3.5, eggs. So this is just how much extra percent increase in cost it will be to the consumer with an increase in bushel of corn. So that's my demand side reasons why I think prices will be higher over the next decade. Now let's look at the supply side. Rise in energy prices, I think all of you agree that the prices are going to go higher again over the next decade, and they've already started inching back up if you look at them closely. So petrol influences those prices pretty well. Land and water constraints, I'm going to go over each one of these. Government intervention, underinvestment in research and infrastructure, and tighter government regulation will increase cost of production. So I'm saying there's a demand side and a supply side on the reason why prices will go higher. Current adverse weather. Globally, this is drought, the dark color, extreme drought, and historic drought. This is a 2008 map, okay? And these are regions of the world that are facing those situations. I know for Australia, you know, you have nomadic farmers now, when that was never the case. So it doesn't matter if you're in extreme drought. It's the extreme fluctuation in weather that's interrupting production. So with that, you get higher prices. This one is a little bit more troubling. If you go back to 2008, and you had those 30 countries that had food riots, they responded quickly. Their governments responded. These are all the countries that implemented some kind of import or export type policy to keep prices low for rice. Okay? And so raise export taxes, export volume restrictions, export ban, reduce import tariffs, increase consumer subsidies, impose price caps. So they managed the system to keep prices stable. Okay? Interfered with the international market. So that drives up prices for everyone outside the country, if you're a producing country. So those are those countries. And these countries on the next slide did both. They needed to attract more, and they needed to retain what they produced. Okay, so China, India, you know, some of the big players there. Okay? This is just last year. What is our long-run capacity to supply? Because we're looking at 10 years out. And we got 800 million more people every year. How do we meet that demand. And so what we're suggesting is you're going to have to bring in marginal land, you're going to have to bring in more efficient water use. Some of the things we've heard you guys talking about, this is why I'm saying I'm impressed you guys get it. efficient feed use, efficient energy use, logistics, the supply chains have to be shorter. And to get that, there has to be an investment where those people, where the demand is. And I showed you once again, that's outside of the industrialized countries. So, where are the exploitable gaps? This is the area that's planted with improved varieties of crops. This is a 2005. So rice, wheat, maize, so on. The darker first color is sub-Saharan Africa. The next one is South Asia, East Asia, Middle East is only shows up in a few of them, okay? And then Latin America and the Caribbean is the last lighter green one. So 20% in sub-Saharan, of rice in sub-Saharan Africa, 25%, is planted to an improved variety. How much more would you get if you had improved varieties? How much more output? What would that do to prices if you had an improved variety? How many of you think that that's possible, that Africa will get improved, will start producing with improved varieties within the next 5 years? Why? They needed you 30 years ago. Anyone know why? Where's this investment going to come from? The investment's coming from the outside. It's the last frontier. And the land hasn't really been abused. Not full of chemicals, you can do organic. I mean, there's a lot of options there. So the investment get huge returns, much better than you can get in the industrialized markets. You look at yields, I mean, it doesn't take a lot of science to go from a flat line since the 1960s to make this an increasing, right? So your impact is phenomenal immediately, okay? So it makes sense, and this is what we're seeing happening. My concern, research and development is not where it needs to be to feed those 800 million people. Research has slowed down dramatically. The last date that we have, one of my colleagues actually did this study, but the last information that we have is when you look at the colors, the first one is 1976 to 81, 1981 to 1991, 91 to 2000. And this is public, private, total global investments in agriculture, research, and development. Yes, sir.
I kept thinking in your last comment. You said 5 years. You don't think we can overcome the lack of infrastructure in 5 years, even if we have all the resources?
I was in Angola a year and a half ago, and we were there collecting data, trying to help them figure out how would you build your food industry system. What was amazing to me, and that's a country that's been in war for 27 years.
Yeah, exactly.
And going from here to your firm would have taken about 2.5 hours, 2.5 to 3 hours. Okay, a lot of transactions cost. However, the Chinese are building roads, bridges, railways, electrical infrastructure 7 days a week. It's amazing how fast things are being transformed. Angola has plans for, they have 9 provinces, to have 500,000 hectare production centers for their own system out in each province, okay, and the trains to ship it right back in. All right, so they're, you know, they used to be more of a communist socialist type system, and so their plans are kind of more of a socialist big agriculture system. But they have oil, they have gold, they have diamonds, so they're trading with the Chinese. And I believe they're going to get there. I mean, it's phenomenal what's happened in just a year. So in 5 years, yeah, I think they can do it. They'll at least become on par. They are one of our largest importers of poultry. just 2 years ago. They were I believe they were ahead of Russia for poultry imports. Okay. Now, you're making me jump ahead. Can I come back to that point on the investment? It's a great question. It's a great question, and I'm going to answer it even fuller in a few more slides. But what I want to bring out here is that high-income countries aren't investing in research and development, except for, when you look over here, private. That's you guys, right? The public is divesting. And if you don't believe me, look at any state university's agriculture budget, and you'll see the divestment. Okay? So, to your point, what are the changing food and trade patterns? Yes?
What do you think the driver is that's reducing that investment? I mean, is it concern of more difficult regulations to be able to develop and register products?
I think everything's other things have just crowded it out. And when's the last time someone that had an income went hungry? When's the last time we had an outbreak that was so devastating that we really needed to understand more about animal or plant production? We don't see it. It's all in movies and in pictures from other countries. And quite frankly, I don't think Americans care. And we don't understand, and we've been more urbanized, right? You got 1% of the population producing food. We don't understand it as a nation. What's really behind all this mechanism? Although in some of the states, agriculture is going to become the leading industry. Michigan, it's going to happen most likely, right? We had auto, tourism, and then agriculture. Well, you know what's going on in auto. Nobody has any money to travel, so it's us, you know. All right. So looking at the trade, I there's so much to talk about trade and how things may change, and you guys know more about China and China than I do. I'm not going to focus on China and China, because what you may not know is China's activities outside, and that's going back to like the Angola story. There are 300 million Chinese living in a middle class lifestyle. Chinese GDP growth expected to continue at 8% annually. Going from 20 to 50 kgs of meat consumption. Land and water constraints, small farm size may make it a net food importer. This is critical to my next statement. And China is investing in other countries to ensure its food supply. What does that look like? Here's China's investment in Africa alone. I know it's small, but over 300 million is the darkest color, okay? Over 100 million and on down, okay? So this is foreign direct investment, straight investment in infrastructure and in production, and for export purposes as well. Okay, so I'm really getting at your question here. In addition to that, human capital offering 4,000 scholarships to African residents to study. Okay, physical capital, roads, dams, oil fields, exports. 40,000 Chinese residents now live in Namibia. How big is Namibia? 1.1 million people. 40,000 is a huge influx of people, right? Racial-wise, it's phenomenal, all right? But they're there for specific purposes, okay? China and Africa trade was expected to reach $100 billion in 2008. The numbers aren't quite out yet, so we're still looking at that. There's a similar trend in Latin America as well, okay? Now, they're not the only ones that are doing this, okay? Other nations are doing this as well. And this is why I think that, yes, Africa can be a breadbasket in a short term, okay? Any questions on that? because this is what you probably aren't thinking about in terms of trade. Yeah.
China's not the only country doing this. I read other books about this as well. Are they doing it to the greater extent in other countries, or
more recent in other countries and in a bigger way? We've been there a long time. I've worked in about 30 different countries, a lot of the countries, from here on down. We do it saying, we want you to be more democratic. We want you to, these touchy-feely things, right? And so we have these ag projects that last for 3 years, and then they stop, and they probably go away, and then we start a new one, right? This is a different type of investment. This is business, right? The infrastructure and extraction of resources to help the mainland. Okay, so it's a totally different approach than how we have done business there for the past, actually for 60 years. Okay, the other nations that are doing some of this are the oil-rich nations as well.
Okay, so is China not placing such expectations or restrictions on these countries then, such as the? And of course, they're not going to from the democracy standpoint. Are they placing any restrictions on it?
Not much. They want the oil in Angola. I went to the ambassador's place, and so they had an event for the Angolans, and we got the mid to lower level people, and she came with maybe $250,000 for projects. It was nothing. You got to talk in the millions to even get the higher levels, because that's what the Chinese are coming for. Okay, and so it's like, I'll send my secretary to that meeting, type thing, versus bringing out the big decision makers. Okay, so I went under Texaco. Texaco was investing in this, and they failed to win the latest rights to the newer oil fields. They couldn't outcompete the Chinese firms. So that's the level that this is at. Any other questions? And did I answer your question?
Yeah, so just another follow-up one. So as far as trading resources out, I understand that's a huge concern, because there are resources that are easily replaced, and there's a lot of environmental issues because there's basically no. Is that true, or has that been
more? No, you're absolutely correct. There are a lot of legal structures are not set up, and so you can get away with a lot of things there and exit the country. Nothing would happen. We have a concern that if all this, a lot of this is looking at biofuels, by the way. If all this goes to biofuels, what happens to the small farmers now and their ability to eat their own food that they produce, because the prices are probably going to be driven up, and so they need to sell it on the market. So price inflation could be very serious in these countries, and that's kind of why I started out with price inflation. What happens to sustainability? It kind of depends. Just showing some imports over time. This is kind of exaggerated simply because the cost of oil, But if you look at, it's a steady increase of soybean meal, soy oil, in terms of product being exported, imported by China. Okay, so this then brings me to the last part, which is the straight sustainability part. But I think you have to understand what's going on globally, the big picture, to see where does sustainability fit into all this, and what's going to happen. So sustainability, in my estimation, happens four ways, and I'm going to go through those four ways. And as a firm, it will cost you more or less. It's an investment that's required, but some ways it's going to cost you more. This is that same point. What is sustainability? Whatever you really want it to be right now, unless Walmart's telling you what it is.
Did I say that?
Well,
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm involved in CFI, Center for Food Integrity.
Yes.
Yes. Walmart part of it. And the head of the, who was brand new at Walmart last year, was the grocery part of the Walmart. And he talked about sustainability, and it's a big thing for Walmart. He was sitting at my table. So when he sat down, I can't remember his name. I said, well, how does Walmart define it? And he said, well, it depends on who you talk to. I can talk to 50 people and get 50 different answers within his own company. We're all for it. We haven't really defined what it is yet. I thought that was very, that seems to be a lot of people wanting to do sustainability.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, and Walmart can help make the decision of what sustainability is. And I think
that they
can't even come to their a concise decision on what it means.
That's correct.
Yeah. I thought that was very good.
Yeah. And there's so much power in the buyer's hand. And these are, you know, my students, 20-somethings, early 20s, and they have, you know, multi-million, billion-dollar accounts, right? And they're making these huge decisions. And all they have to do is ask for one more thing that could put a firm out of business, right? So everyone has a definition. What we do know is that CIES is all the top supermarket chains around the world. They belong to CIES. They meet in Europe each year. And so this is where corporate social responsibility has ranked over the time. And this number one ranking in 2008 is solely due to sustainability. So it is on the top of their mind because their consumers are interested in this. From Europe, you get a lot of this as well, okay, this driving force. And so Walmart, what I interpret what they're doing is they were followers in Europe, they will be leaders in the U.S., okay? They go under ASDA there in the U.K. So I'm going to use two European firms, actually U.K. firms, who've invested in this, and so you can understand where we are probably going in terms of on the demand side. Demand-driven sustainability. Tesco is one of the largest supermarket chains there. They put carbon counts on 70,000 products, which means that you can look at the product and you can tell how much carbon is used to produce it. The consumers want that. Half of the UK consumers want carbon footprint information. Half would switch to a low-carbon brand. They also are interested in the livestock and how much that contributes to global warming. Tesco has three strategies: greening the company, greening their supply chain, and greening its customers by making eco choices easier. Okay, so that's labeling and forcing things back down the chain, right? Which eventually reach you. Another one, Marks & Spencer's, another big firm there in the UK. Every year, Marks & Spencer will sell over 20 million garments made from fair trade cotton. Label food imported by air, because there was this wacky study that was done that air miles is more detrimental to the environment than things that are shipped by boats, which has been refuted. Convert all eggs, fresh turkey, geese, duck, and pork to free range. I heard a statement, I'm not sure who said it this morning, that your genetics don't do well or will not do well in free-range environment. Use of that. Yeah.
Poultry is not much different, though, right?
Okay. So that's something you want to start thinking about, the base. Marks & Spencer's own brand influences extends to over 2,000 factories, 10,000 farmers, 250,000 workers, and 500 UK stores. This is one firm, okay? And so on the demand side, you have to understand what they're facing, what their goals are, and how that will eventually affect your business. And they make the statement it's equivalent to taking 100,000 cars off the road. Here's how they convey this message to the consumers. And you'll see that it's a wise choice by the consumers to buy this higher priced good in some cases. So, I'll just quickly get to one that I really like here. So you see the signage, if you could see that. I'm sorry, it's a little bit small. they talk about this plan A, and one of these tells me, there it is. Plan A, because there is no plan B. Very effective. Plan A, because there's no plan B. Plan A, obviously, is buying sustainable goods. And they outline all this stuff. They are communicating to the consumer. Here's their system, their symbols, so you can easily understand what's sustainable, what's not sustainable. There are experimentations going on here in the U.S. doing a similar type thing. Okay? Most people get confused by all the different labels that we have. Right? So this is demand-driven. This is manufacturer-led sustainability, low-carbon image. So these life cycle analysis, everyone's being requested to do that. Where is the energy or carbon in your supply chain? So Ben and Jerry's has done one. This is a Walker Crisp, which is nothing but potato chips out of the UK. And in both cases, I show this to show that 65 to 75% of the carbon footprint is at the farm level. Okay, so when you're doing the life cycle analysis, this is where the retailers are going to say, hey, improve it. It's going to be at the farm level.
Well, let me ask you a question. I'll go back to the dairy thing I'm talking about today. And
Yeah.
Actually a carbon footprint of 23% of what it was in 1940. And a lot of that relates to the high production agriculture system that we have today. Mm-hmm. While it's being go to the dairy, you can talk poultry where you go from what we're using now for layer, for example, to cage-free, your system is going to become less efficient. Mm-hmm. Your carbon footprint is probably going to get bigger, and the overall production potential efficiency could go down. I mean, maybe not an answer. How do you balance that, and how is a consumer going to balance that in the future, that carbon footprint is important? And that's one of the things that we've been able to do, for example, in dairy. Increased by more than 75%. That's pretty impressive when you think about it. But now we're getting on the other side of animal welfare, and we have to change that and go back the other way. That's kind of the dilemma I think the producer is getting into when we come in. Do you conform with what is being asked by the consumer, or do you help the consumer understand the bigger impact?
Yeah.
I'm not saying what we're doing is right.
Yeah.
It's more related to what is more important to you. That's kind of what I was trying to ask earlier. Okay. Environmental impact, feeding the expanding population, or animal welfare. Not that I'm saying you can only do one or the other, but they all interplay.
Yeah.
I don't know that the consumer understands that completely.
Part of this depends on who educates the consumer.
That's true.
and that's where I get to what the firm can do. We're losing in this communication battle. We're getting slaughtered. Yeah. Excuse the pun. But it's a deal at a witness here. We're getting beat up. And it doesn't matter that your science-based, logical explanation is all that. It doesn't matter at all.
That was obviously most of it in Europe.
Right. Exactly.
That was an emotional suit.
There it is. It's emotional. And once again, as we get more urban globally, less people understand this whole system, right? They just want to demand more, okay? And this life cycle analysis, you guys haven't been contacted yet by any firm to say, well, what's your carbon footprint?
Actually, we have.
Okay, I would be surprised if you haven't by now. Yeah, okay, all right. The next one is advocacy group-led sustainability. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with what happened to McDonald's a couple of years ago. I think it was 2005. But Greenpeace really rocked their world and some other groups by simply saying, going to the Amazon, showing over time that there was deforestation going on and soybeans were being planted. Well, McDonald's, like most companies would say, we had nothing to do with that. Well, come to find out, only 1% of McDonald's products is based on these soybeans that come from this region. But they were the biggest company to attack, right? Most visible company to attack. So there were all kinds of protests. You'll see foul play at McDonald's and all kinds of horrible things. The Amazon and we're trashing it over here. Okay, so it's this major campaign against McDonald's, and they had pretty good factual pictures to go along with it. So McDonald's had to come up with a totally different approach to this. And one of the smartest things that they did do was to invite these, what they consider radical groups, in for a conversation. And they flew down there. And they looked around. And they worked with Cargill to mitigate the situation. Okay? Now, the smart thing McDonald's does, and I actually am involved with this, they have about 250 people that they send out their sustainability report to. And we go through it, and it's laborious. But everyone voices their opinion on what should be stated and where, you know, more work needs to be done. Just be honest. And so they have some of their former adversaries working with them to do this. And so this is one of the McDonald's guerrilla forest. They have some mitigation projects around the world. But they turn that into a positive thing. The fourth and final way that sustainability is done is legislated. Now, I don't care what logical explanation you have, you can't beat the dancing pig with it. You can't top this one. I don't know if you watched the whole video or not. It's really nice. He goes through, and you know, the chickens are there. You got all your animals. You guys are in trouble here. Got all your animals, and he goes through and he lets them loose, and everybody is happy. They're dancing and having a good time. So this is what's being given to legislators and children. Now, is this accurate? Is this the best way to produce meat, protein? We're not invited to the table to help make that decision. And that's the problem that we have with that. Okay? This is going to expand. So realize that in your business, that you're going to be facing this in other states as well. So, last slide. As I said, sustainable food supply chain growth depends on those global trends, the demand factors that we talked about, the supply factors, the trade issues, okay, as well as our ability to educate consumers, policymakers, and CEOs. Okay, because not all CEOs get this, right? Properly accounting for the cost of our current food supply chain is the other part that I think hasn't been done well, and that is the water that we use, the transportation and logistics, and what other mitigating effects will this have? If we use more biofuels, how many people will be hungry? It's 1 billion now. We have this growing number of people in the world. It does have an effect. So let's figure this out. So, what questions do you have? Thank you. What questions do you have?
So, I guess from a dairy standpoint, we've heard a lot of stories, you know, I hear a lot of conferences where they talk about feeding a hungry world and so forth. And the dairy farmers have heard that message, and so they hear it after production. I'm not saying that's the only reason they did it, but they hear this message that we have to feed a hungry world. And so they did that, and then the export market got pulled out from under them, and now they're suffering some of the prices. So as a producer, how do you respond to this? Do you get over-optimistic, or how do you deal with that?
Yeah. As a producer in the U.S., is what I think you're referring to. You know, our market is flat in the U.S. And so what are the opportunities abroad is really what you're looking at. This past year, I would not base much on this past year. If you could survive this past year, that would be about the best you can hope for. I don't think we're going to remain at this state. because there's too many other things going on. If it's a global recession, some places it's a depression. And this will probably last for about another year or so. So after that, though, relative to income, cost of food has increased. And that's where you're getting this downward trend on the prices of food. People just can't afford it. If they're a luxury good, they're not buying it. A luxury food good, they're not buying it. If it's a commodity that's in their diet, then they are focused on those cheaper goods. So, you know, do we have oversupply at the wrong time? Some would say yes. Right. And I think if you can ride it out, that's the best thing you can do, because I think better times are coming. For the demand reasons that I showed you there. And there is a contraction that's happening in the market right now. People are having to sell off stock.
Yeah. Yeah, you mentioned that the agricultural industry is getting blogger in the media on issues of sustainability. Is there any way that you can think of that?
We've had a few good success stories in the past going straight to the consumer, and that's that milk commercial years ago with Mustache, when the Generation X, I guess it was, wasn't consuming milk. And then they showed all the athletes with drinking milk, and it does the body good. That was a direct promotion that worked, increased consumption. You have firms doing some of this as well. But an issue like sustainability, it has to be more of a collaborative approach. And I think you have to have honest brokers on the table as well, such as universities, government. I think we all have to get at the table to put something more behind this. I don't think a firm on its own or industry on its own is going to counter what's going on in this activity. Because if you look at some of the things that are behind this, it's they don't want people to eat meat. Some of these organizations don't want you to eat meat at all. And so it doesn't matter what you say in terms of science for that, but you still have to have them at the table.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think from our experience, the sustainability thing is going to happen.
Yeah.
Period. I mean, yeah. No, I don't think that's a discussion. It's going to happen. I think we're better off being part of the discussion than pretending it isn't going to happen.
Right.
So we need to be part of it and try to help define it.
You got to be proactive, and you know, we used to have ag in the classroom. We used to have more, but now it has to not be with farm kids. That's something that we're still doing poorly, is we're not reaching the group that we need to, which are those major consumers and these huge populations that we were talking about. You know, farm kids just aren't in anymore. You know, even in my classes, I have like 180 undergrads for one of my class. Only about 25 will have serious ag backgrounds. The rest are learning about the food supply chain for the first time. Okay? So we have to do a lot more on the education side.
And so do we start lower than the county?
Oh, yeah.
High school, elementary?
Elementary.
Yeah.
Because
images are formed by the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I have another project because I hate to say this, but Detroit is a lot like a developing country, okay, in many ways. And so I started doing some work in Detroit. And if you look at what's offered, there's in this one area, it's like 30 liquor stores. And that's where people have to buy their, if they don't have transportation, that's where they have to buy their food from. Fresh fruits and vegetables aren't there. And so that's what our work is on, fresh fruits and vegetables and transforming snacks so that you have healthy snacks that are based on fresh fruits and vegetables. If we just had a normal price good in our urban centers and a child experiences that early on, you know what that would do to demand? But right now, they're overpriced, poor quality, and hard to access, right? So there's some mistakes that we're making in our overall food supply chain. You know, we built all these stores on the outside of the city, and your consumers are on the inside. It makes no sense at all.
So is it, okay, so is it then, is it public dollars or private dollars that go to those institutions to try to...
Public dollars are disappearing.
Yeah, I know. I knew that was the answer, but I just don't want to ask the question. Because I'm hoping that that's not the answer.
Can I say it again? Public dollars are disappearing. and so that's why more effective partnerships have to be formed. And I think that's what I'm saying. You can't do it alone. We can't do it alone. The government can't do it alone. You know, they even talk about the pyramid for ages. You know, has that changed anybody's consumption? You know, most of us don't even know what's on the pyramid, except for a few things. You know, but they've been preaching to us for a long time.
Until chocolate gets to the top of the pyramid,
my wife is not she's not paying attention to it, right?
But, you know, I understand the partnership, and I think that is something you need to look at. You know, realistically, China is investing in Africa because they want to obviously get the first position.
Yep.
And as these things start to produce, the export is well. I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. They expect a return.
So, somehow we got to figure out how to find our kind of balance.
Yeah.
People that are investing in Africa.
Yeah.
I just had a comment when we were talking about educating children, especially here in the U.S., talking about how they harm them with aid and supplies and all those things. And, I mean, I'm surprised at, you know, we talked about how really do we get there. Well, those that do not want children to be me are giving to children at a very young age. Because my daughter's 8, and if I look at a magazine here for little kids like that, there are already advertisements in there with fluffy chicks saying, I don't want to be a nugget, things like that. I mean, it's just amazing. So they're already getting messages. I mean, she came home from deciding and declaring that she was going to be a vegetarian and eating peanut butter because it came from elephants. I mean, there's just...
I'm sorry.
So then she got a little confused about, you know,
yeah, okay.
She's getting a lot of mixed messages, you know, beginning at 3 or 4 years old and up.
Oh, 3 and 4.
So, I'm amazed that the discussion that she wanted to have about what it meant to be a vegetarian a few years ago was really important for her story.
Yeah. And then you throw up, okay, so that's animal welfare. And then you throw in that you're destroying the environment by having these animals. You know, we're so far behind on this discussion. So there's a lot of work that has to be done. And I don't mean to depress you before dinner here. Yeah. Other questions?
What is the reality? Do you see something real regulation? Different ways and different needs? Do you see that as a fact and is it a business because I can't even see that thing? So that means for one day, they're moving faster than us.
Yeah.
Because they're already making cashing numbers. They're helping to solve the issue.
They don't have to solve it. And you know, the other thing that we haven't realized, I don't think, is how inexpensive it is to communicate with the public, and they have, right? It's so easy to use Facebook, all these other types of networks, blogs, and we're not doing that effectively, right? I saw that whole room that you guys have of tech people, you know, if you had half of them sending out blogs or, you know, and changing the discussion, that would make a difference. Well, if every firm shared people, something has to be more structured than what we have. Because, you know, you have people sitting at home in their pajamas, you know, doing what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Don't become a McNugget. Yeah. Any other questions?
So the other thing, when I was talking about the difficulties that I see for this for the business I'm in.
Yeah.
You know, they're trying to reverse some of the processes that became part of the progress, like sending these sounds back to Japan. That is a midterm for this producer. How do we deal with that? We're too close to for this industry. That's what we do. So the transition of you is going to be very difficult for those companies.
And that's what I was saying, that the cost for your firm could be excessive if, depending on if it's manufacturer-led, demand-driven, legislative, right? How you enter your discussion about sustainability, and if you happen to choose the right path, because once again, that word is not defined, and you don't know what it means for your supply chain, where's the best way to invest your money, right? You guys investing in solar panels, or LEED building, and so on. Is that going to meet the threshold that Walmart's going to set? We don't know. Are there another set of R&D investments that you're going to have to make? Probably. Are they excessive? Is it changing the genetic strains that you work with? Part of that solution. Because now it has to be a larger pen or a free range pen. Does it change everything? Does it change your total price? That could be extremely expensive and put you out of the market.
The impact can be bigger than we see. Because in the meantime, how do you produce protein? Just to drop one of the factors.
You probably import it for a little while. I mean, you guys can play both sides of the pond, but the farmers that you work with here in this country, you know, they could go by the wayside, some of them, but because they can't adapt. Anytime you have a technological innovation, you don't bring 100% with
it. Yeah, one of the problems in this particular case is not only for people for it, but also for poultry. The genetic lines have been grown from the same source. So we basically use the same genetic lines all over. So that's going to be a big challenge.
So the way to reduce cost to your firm is to get ahead of the curve, right? And start thinking about some of these things and see how you can mitigate some of those. Worst thing that a firm can face is a shock. So the California farmers face a shock. Just 2 years and it's over. All right. So you know a lot of them are going to drop out of the market. And it changes the value of all their assets, all the fixed things that they have, even if they wanted to move to another state. Then they got to think how much longer before the same law is passed in that state. They can look overseas. Does that fit? So the least costly for the firm is to help make the change. For you to communicate with a Walmart and say, this is what's good. That's the least costly way if you think Walmart's going to lead this review. So that's what I would suggest to any firm that is in the food industry. Because it is going to change.
Don't fight it.
Don't fight it. Help lead it. Okay? Not just join it. Help lead it. Because you then have part of your science and knowledge in directing it. That'd be less costly to you than anything else.
Very good.
Thank you. Everybody, cheers for me.